From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. An historic first is before the Texas Supreme Court. For the first time, a state court will determine who has the legal right to make life and death decisions for premature babies. In this hour, parents' rights and doctors' responsibilities. We begin tonight with fresh evidence that the much-anticipated economic recovery has not fully arrived. New unemployment numbers out today are the highest in 8 years. Greg Ipp is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Earlier, I asked what the new spike means in unemployment terms.
The unemployment numbers on the surface look pretty discouraging. The unemployment rate shot up to 6%, which is the highest it's been since 1994. We did actually have some net creation of jobs, a little over 40,000 to be precise, and the reason we had the unemployment rate go up at the same time that we created more jobs was that basically a lot of people flooded into the labor market looking for work, and so they were counted as unemployed, and that caused the unemployment rate to go up. But this negative story on the surface shouldn't be taken too badly. Number one, it's not uncommon for the unemployment rate to rise a bit in the early stages of recovery for exactly this reason, because the improved outlook causes people who previously thought no work was available to come in and look for it. And the other reason,
so they hear that there's something brewing out there, and they go out to find it, and in the process, we get higher unemployment numbers as that works through.
Exactly. You might have had somebody, for example, who had decided to retire early because there was no work to be found, and he's decided to go look for work again. Or somebody, for example, who had decided to go back to school, has dropped out of school and decided to look for another job. And there were a couple of other positive signs. The rate of decline in manufacturing employment was one of the lowest we've seen since before the recession began. And there was an uptick in the hiring of temporary staff, and there's good evidence to suggest this could be a leading indicator, because employers, before they make a commitment to a permanent hire, they might want to say, let's see if the sales increase sticks around and we'll just stick with temporary employment for now.
So highest unemployment figures in 8 years, but it may in fact be a good sign that people are responding to news of an uptick in the economy. It was only a few weeks ago that we had word that the economic growth rate was way up there, way ahead of what people expected.
Absolutely. There's been a bit of a reality check since we got that number, Tom. The growth rate in the first quarter was very, very strong, 5.8%, one of the strongest in several years. But keep in mind that a lot of that was simply because the rate of inventory sell-off that we had in late 2001 was so steep that there was nothing left on the shelves to sell. And it was inevitable that you would have some increase in production as the year began, just to restock those shelves. But that's not a permanent boost to the economy. It's only temporary, and sure enough, it does not seem to have carried on the same rate of expansion in the second quarter that we had in the first. That's not the same as saying the economy is slipping back, that we're having a double dip by any stretch of the imagination. But it does suggest that the growth going forward is going to be a little bit more restrained than we started the year with.
The job creation that was there, and as you say, there was a fair bit of it, the losses in manufacturing were not there, you say, Greg. Do we just expect to see losses in every quarter in manufacturing employment now? Is that a permanent fixture?
It's kind of a discouraging thought, isn't it? Well, clearly manufacturers have had quite a few things going against them in the last 2 years. Number one, the recession, but also things like the very high dollar, which has made it hard to compete both overseas and here against foreign producers. And at some point, this has got to come to an end because, number one, the recession is pretty much over, as we know. And also, the dollar has actually started weakening in the last few weeks. So I think there's actually a very good chance that manufacturing employment may have stabilized and could start rising in the coming months.
If you look across sectors, what areas are we seeing strong employment? What areas are we seeing unemployment?
Well, services, which has been a very strong area for most of the recession period, continues to be strong. We even had an improvement in transportation, which has been hard hit because of the layoffs in airlines, for example. Construction had been an area of strength. As you know, the housing market has done very well throughout the last year, and it did especially well over the winter because we had such warm weather that a lot of builders kept building right through the winter instead of laying down tools. We've had a little bit of a payback as the spring came on, as some of that warm weather effect slipped away from us. And also, finally, the government's been in there steadily hiring at both the local and the federal level. Got to put all those baggage screeners on the payroll somewhere.
What's the job outlook for students coming out of school, both new college grads and people looking for summer employment?
Well, it's a bit mixed, Tom. It's not that great if you are, for example, just looking for summer work. For example, the unemployment rate for teenagers, those who are 16 to 19 years old, it's still pretty high. It's 12.5%, and that's up about 2 percentage points from a year earlier.
And, of course, what we should clarify there, that means teenagers who want work but can't find it.
That's exactly correct. And that's, and as you can see, that is roughly a double the overall unemployment rate. But if you've got a skill, if you're coming out of college with a skill, then the prospects are all still pretty bright. Now, it is true that the recession we had was pretty rough on the white-collar classes, all those dot-coms going away and all those people in high-tech companies suddenly discovering that it wasn't an endless gravy train out there. But even after all that, the unemployment rate for college graduates is still only 3%. So that suggests that the market out there for those with a skill is still very strong.
So, Greg Ipp, we'll make you chairman of the Federal Reserve for a moment. You're looking at these growth rates. You're looking at this unemployment. They've cut interest rates 11 times last year.
Yeah.
They're almost down to zero. any more cuts in the works, or are we steady as she goes?
More cuts are pretty unlikely. As you said, we're at a very low interest rate now. 1.75% is the rate charged on the Fed's target money market rate. That's still the lowest it's been since 1961. And there doesn't seem to be much dispute among economists that if they left it there for long, we'd inevitably start getting an inflation problem. But right now, the Fed has lots of room to wait to make sure that the economy and the recovery are actually on a pretty firm footing before they start to take back some of those 11 interest rate cuts. And the main reason they can be this confident is, number one, the inflation rate is virtually non-existent. There seems to be a growing conviction among Fed officials that they have at long last defeated inflation. And the other reason is that, for some of the reasons you and I have just been discussing, the slowing in growth since the first quarter, is that we are just not at a very strong pace of growth yet, the kind of thing that we can take for granted. So for those reasons, I think it could be a few more months yet before we see the Federal Reserve start to raise interest rates.
Greg Ipp, thanks very much for joining us.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
Greg Ipp is a reporter with The Wall Street Journal. He spoke to us from Washington. In 1990, when she was just 5 months pregnant, a Texas woman named Carla Miller went into labor. Doctors told her there was a slim chance the baby would survive after birth without drastic medical intervention, and if intervention saved the baby, it would likely face devastating lifelong complications. After much anguish, the Millers decided no extra heroic effort should be taken. But hours later, they were told that the hospital was duty-bound to do everything to save the baby anyway. The child, a girl named Sydney, was born profoundly disabled. She is now 11 years old and requires 24-hour care. The Millers sued the hospital and won millions in damages. The case was overturned by an appeals court and has now been argued before the Texas Supreme Court. A decision is expected soon. It's a heartbreaking story, but what are the legal and moral issues at stake here? Who should make life and death decisions for premature infants? How far should medicine go? Do parents have the right to deny treatment before it's even known if a child can survive? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is George Annis, chair of the Health Law Department at Boston University's School of Public Health and author of The Rights of Patients. Good evening and welcome, George Annis.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. George Annis, it's an awful story. The mother was at risk of death herself. She had an infection in the womb. The parents were told, you've got to make a decision about this. They were told, if we take these extreme measures to save this extremely premature baby, it is likely to have severe lifelong disabilities, and in fact that came true. The parents, they anguished over this. They decided not to go ahead with this birth, not to take those extreme measures, to leave it up to nature. They were told that the odds were that the baby would die in that case. The father had already gone to the funeral home to pick out a tiny coffin. He came back. The hospital had reversed everything. They said, we're going ahead. Whatever happened to leaving such an extreme case to nature? Is that just not an option for us legally or ethically anymore when technology has the means to preserve the life, even if not the quality of life?
Well, it's more complicated than just leaving it to nature. Obviously, if we just wanted to do that, we wouldn't have things like neonatal intensive care units or neonatologists even, or maybe even pediatricians.
But is there no point at which nature gets to have some role in this, at which we can say, lay off the technology, it's just too much, and the downside risk is too great?
Well, sure. There certainly is. I mean, there's some easy cases, and the easy cases, the so-called anencephalic baby, so babies born without an upper cortex. No one in their right mind would try to resuscitate that child, although it's been done on a few occasions, because there's no chance that child could live. There are other babies born with so severe anomalies that it's very clear once they're diagnosed they're going to die shortly. The tough case is when you're not sure. you're pretty sure, in this case, they were pretty sure the child would die, and if it didn't die, it would likely be severely impaired, but no one was certain. Although they were certain enough that the doctors, you're absolutely right, agreed with the parents initially that they wouldn't resuscitate.
They said, it's going to be horrific. They said, as the mother describes it, they said, if we have to, what's the term, intubate the baby, that is, force oxygen into this 1 pound, 5 ounce baby, then at a pressure far greater than that tiny body could withstand, there would be catastrophic disabilities that would result. So they told the parents this. The parents said, no, let's not do that. And here the parents are.
Well, yes. And as a general rule, the parents do have the legal authority to make that decision. If the doctor doesn't, the doctor did agree with it here, but if the doctor doesn't agree with it, it's the doctor's job to go to court and seek a court order, which they could only get if the judge finds that the decision the parents made is amounts to child neglect, that no reasonable parent would subject their child to this. So this is not in the best interest of the child, if you will.
Why didn't the parents have that right in this case? They were in the hospital. They only had one choice. The mother's life was on the line. They couldn't move her to another hospital. They were told the decision was made. Then it was done.
Yeah, well, I think they should have. And that's, of course, why this case went to court and why this case is now going to the Texas Supreme Court, because obviously there was a failure of communication here. There were failures to lay out the options to the parents and give the parents options. And even, again, if the hospital, so-called hospital, and the suit is against the hospital, not against the doctors, if the hospital disagreed, it's the hospital's obligation to go to court. The hospital doesn't just get to do whatever it wants to do for anyone, infant, adult, or incompetent person. The hospital has no right to treat anyone against their will, even a child, with the one exception in a frank emergency when there's no time to go to court, then they can't treat. But that was not this case.
So take us back. Let's step back and look at this. As technology makes neonatal care more and more dramatic and makes intervention possible at younger and younger and younger ages, sometimes with severe consequences, as we saw in this case, is there, I don't know, take us through the legal side and the moral side. Are there points at which reasonable people could rationally disagree over whether or not a 1 pound, 5 ounce baby, let's say, ought to be saved? And what are the legal and ethical arguments that frame that case?
Well, certainly people do disagree. That some people believe neonatal intensive care units are set up to do everything they can. That's why they're there. And they should attempt to save every child. And that's their job. Other people think that we've gone way overboard with neonatal intensive care units, that when they do try to save every life, they wind up harming a lot of children, that many children do survive, miraculous in itself, but with very severe handicaps similar to the case we have with the Millers. And that given the uncertainty, I mean, if you knew how it was going to come out, it was just life and death, you know, like a blood transfusion and everybody's going to be healthy, that's not a hard decision.
That's easy.
You know, people refuse blood transfusions. We say, you can't do that. The courts always routinely order them. But the fact that it's very uncertain how this child is going to come out makes this a very difficult case. And there certainly are people who disagree on how it should come out. And that's why most people, and I believe the courts as well, will say that ultimately the parents have to make this decision. It's not that it's their child, not that they own the child, but it is that they have the most interest in the child. They love the child. They're the ones who are most interested in the welfare of the child. They're the ones that are going to have to take care of the child. So ultimately it's their decision. Again, with the caveat that if they make a decision that is totally is unreasonable and it's against the welfare of the child, then the courts can and should step in.
So is this case an exception to the rule in that the hospital just came in and laid down the law, said this is what will happen despite the parents' choice?
It's unusual in that situation. I mean, actually, we had this giant discussion back in the 80s when President Reagan was president and Dr. Koop was Surgeon General. We had this long discussion about baby do-regs and whether it was ever appropriate not to treat a severely handicapped child. And ultimately, going back and forth and up and down the U.S. Supreme Court, the decision was child neglect is the outside limit, and now we have to discuss when it is child neglect not to treat.
We're talking about micro preemies tonight, and who should decide the fate of radically mature births? Who should decide if a dramatically premature baby should be saved? The parents, doctors, hospital lawyers? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about radically premature infants and the technology, the intersection of technology and ethics. It's so difficult around that subject. The Texas Supreme Court has a case in front of it right now where parents were told that if maximum intervention was undertaken to save their 1 pound, 5 ounce child, it would very likely be severely disabled for life. They said, no, thank you. The hospital overruled them. Now they're living with the consequences 11 years later. Is it right for a hospital to insist that a micro preemie be saved, no matter what the lifetime health consequences? Should parents have the right to refuse extraordinary intervention if a micro preemie is at risk of profound lifetime disablement? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined in the studio by George Annis. He's chair of the Health Law Department at Boston University's School of Public Health and author of The Rights of Patients. And now by Dr. Marilee Allen. She's associate director of neonatology at Johns Hopkins Children's Center and was an expert witness in the Texas case. Good evening and welcome, Dr. Marilee Allen.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. First, tell us, what role did you play in the Texas case? Who were you representing?
I was a medical expert witness for the family in this case, and my role was really to testify about what the standard of care was at that time that this baby was delivered, about how those decisions were made.
We should clarify, the child, Sydney, is about 11 years old now. She is able to do almost nothing, nearly blind, can barely move, can't feed herself or walk or talk, has a kind of six-month-old mentality, I understand. Does it look to you, Marilee Allen, in retrospect, that the hospital did the right thing in bringing in the big technology to save this tiny, tiny infant?
Well, my position is that the family should have been respected, and the decision that the family made was completely overruled by the hospital without having an ethics committee meeting or without going to court in terms of overruling the family. So I think they did not do the right thing.
How common is this situation these days when you have a premature birth? At what weight or age, I guess, of development do these issues of potential lifetime health problems come into play, Dr. Allen?
Well, at the time that this baby was born, the limit of viability was right around 23 to 24 weeks gestation, and she was at the very lowest limit of that at 23 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
It's changed a little bit over the last decade. Now there are reported a few survivors at 22 weeks and even at 21 weeks, but they are so few that it's hard to get enough of them together to really get a sense of how those children do.
So that's the limit of where they can possibly save the children. But give us a sense, what's the range? We all hear about hospitals dealing with premature babies who are not nearly that early, where the success rate, the outcome is likely to be very high, and these issues of fear of lifetime health problems are much lower. Where is the sort of boundary land between high risk and fairly standard now?
Well, when we've looked at it in the past, and I believe it's still true now, there is no one clear line above which the child is safe. That each week of gestation, their chances of survival improve and the likelihood of complications becomes less. So that they're, you know, by 24 weeks, there's better survival, maybe 50% or more. At 25 weeks, probably 80% of babies survive. So at each week of gestation, there is a greater chance of survival, but also all the complications of prematurity that these children are so vulnerable to, the likelihood of those complications is less.
At what point then do hospitals begin to turn to parents and say, you have a decision to make here? These are the potential complications of neonatal intervention.
Well, I don't think it's right to pick it just in terms of a specific birth weight or a specific gestational age, although I think we do have the clinicians do have a pretty good idea of approximately where that those decisions would come into play. But I do think that at the very lowest limit of viability, when there's not even a 50-50% chance that the child will live, and there's a very high likelihood of disability, but also injury to many organs, the eyes, the lungs, the GI tract, as well as bleeding and other kinds of severe injury to the brain can occur.
So are you saying that this is not a dilemma that faces, well, what percentage of parents who deal with a premature birth are faced with the dilemma of having to decide?
Well, you know, it's a relatively small group who are born right at the lowest limit of viability, but those are the babies and those are the families that we all remember because we agonize so about it. But the vast majority of premature babies have a good chance at survival. Certainly 25 weeks and above, the likelihood of survival is wonderful. And just for your listeners, 40 weeks is term, so we're talking about being 4 months pregnant or just a little bit over 4 months pregnant. Beyond that, there is a much better chance of survival, and I think that we all feel very positive about intervening and really doing whatever we can to save the babies.
So, Georgianis, once again, it's technology taking us right out to that frontier where we face questions we might not have faced before. It seems every time we turn around on this show, we're faced with some new dilemma that's produced by human capacity to intervene, by capacity to save, but may also raise ethical dilemmas. Is technology pushing us beyond our ability to make clear ethical decisions?
Well, actually, I don't think so in this case. As Dr. Allen pointed out, you know, in the last 10 or 15 years, things haven't changed that much. There may be one or two or a handful of 21 and 22 weekers who have survived, but mostly the real dilemmas are here at 23 weeks and 24 weeks, you know, where the 50-50 case, you know, seems to me, I agree with her, I'm not sure she'd say this, but if the chances are less than 50-50 that the child will live, and if it lives, it could be severely handicapped, that seems to me to be an easy case for the parents to make the decision. If it's more than 50% that the child will live and it will live a reasonable life, then it seems to me that's also an easy case for the judge to say we have to treat, even if the parents don't want to.
And does that tend to be the point where hospitals turn to parents and say, what shall we do?
Well, actually, I don't think that there is any Dr. Allison, she testified on standard of care. There is a standard of care, I think, for physicians. I doubt there is for hospitals. I really think that the hospital as an institution really probably shouldn't be very much involved here at all, unless it's through something like an ethics committee, as she also mentioned. But the hospital administrator, I mean, really, who cares what the hospital administrator says? He or she is primarily interested, unfortunately, in legal liability and not necessarily in the best interest of the child.
Certainly, the parents in this case don't feel they were well served. They went through their insurance payments in very short order, and then later, I guess in 98, won a $43 million settlement that was overturned in appeal. Their concern now is that one day this child, with all of her disabilities, will outlive them, and who will care for the child? Where will the money come from?
Oh, yeah, we should be very clear. The parents have spent almost full time caring for this child since it's been born. This child has been their life, and they could easily institutionalize this child, and many parents would have, but they don't. They are taking care of this child.
Just because technology makes a rescue possible, does that mean we are obligated to save every micro preemie, whatever the risks? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Ruth is on the line. Welcome, Ruth. You're on the air.
Hello.
Good evening.
Well, I think I have an interesting perspective and perhaps, you know, a little bit more knowledge than I would have liked. I actually am a practicing gynecologist.
Okay.
And I have four and a half years ago had micropreemie twins.
Mm-hmm.
And it was sort of the worst case scenario for an obstetrician to know so much, to be at 23 and a half weeks with twins, bleeding with 3 grams of magnesium sulfate, which is a miserable medication to be on to try to stop labor.
So did you face the same kind of dilemma that we're hearing about tonight, Ruth?
Absolutely. And I don't wish it on anyone. We had actually, when it came down to it, very few decisions to make. And I guess we thought we had decisions to make, but we actually didn't.
Now, what do you mean by that, Ruth? The hospital didn't ask, or there was no question? What?
Well, it's sort of this, if you're in the Boston area, it means that if you're delivering in a teaching hospital, that there is this sort of machine that occurs. When you have access to sort of a level three nursery, then it's more likely that it's going to be initiated.
So, but the question is, were you facing the same concern that the couple in Texas were, that in this case your twins might be saved, but saved in a condition that you might not want to see them in?
Yes. But, you know, what's interesting was that you basically have to, at this point, really rely on your neonatologist to make the best judgment they can. And it's interesting because the firstborn has survived and has done very well. He'll come on the line to talk to you. But the second boy died, and there was no effort that would have helped. And it was something intrinsic about the baby that wanted to go for it, basically.
And the decision you're saying was made by the doctors, essentially, Ruth?
Well, the doctor looking at the condition of the baby, and then once the baby was admitted to the NICU, we really had no decisions to make. We were on a roller coaster. We didn't know where it was going, and that was our child.
Were you ever tempted to say, no, don't intervene?
Well, I couldn't, but we, you know, as a couple, my husband was initially afraid to go there. You know, he said, well, I don't think we can do this. But it wasn't a question. It wasn't a question because we were there. And, you know.
Do you mean by that, Ruth, that the hospital never asked you if they should go ahead?
Well, once a baby is born and is doing relatively well, considering you're a 24-weeker and just over a pound, you actually... you would have to have a tremendous proactive stand to start withdrawing care on a fetus that is doing relatively well.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, you know, we didn't go that route. You know, if you do everything you can to try to, you know, keep a pregnancy for 20 to 24 weeks, it seems kind of paradoxical just to give up.
Yeah, there's so much invested already. Ruth, thank you for sharing your story, and we wish your son a long and beautiful life.
Yes, thank you.
Thanks for calling. Marilee Allen, here Ruth faced an almost comparable age, I guess, or a point in the pregnancy, 23 weeks, and the question wasn't really asked. Things seem to have just churned ahead. Is that typical around the country now?
Well, I think the vast majority of families are very invested in their child at that point in the pregnancy, and they do want us to do as much as we can. And there are certainly times that we don't think the baby's going to do well. The parents decide they would really prefer that the child not suffer. But then the baby's born and is very vigorous. And I actually warn families that that might happen because then things do change. And I do think that most families at that point let's give it a try, would feel that way about it. So, that you know, the technology can sometimes be a wonderful thing that's life-saving, but at other times it just prolongs the suffering.
Sometimes for a lifetime.
Sometimes for a lifetime.
I want to bring in Dr. Sheldon Koronis. He's director of the Newborn Center at Regional Medical Center in Memphis, professor at the University of Tennessee College of Medicine. Good evening and welcome, Dr. Koronis.
Good evening.
Thanks for joining us. You have a medical center that is dealing with neonatal issues, problems, and babies and successes all the time. Are you open to parents who say, when they hear what the risks of intervention are, say, you know what, the risks of some lifetime problem are just too great, we want to stop it right here?
What do you mean by open?
I guess, do you put the question to parents if the neonatal intervention may result in some kind of lifetime disability? Do you ask, should we proceed?
Generally, when I talk to parents, the whole purpose of my being there is for the parents to determine whether or not they want to proceed. They generally call me at a 23, 24-week pregnancy that threatens to deliver because they have heard from one source or another about all the risks. Now, this program and so many others and so many articles have really presented the risks to, not to the exclusion of, but we spent a lot of time talking about the ugly outcomes and not an awful lot of time about the happy ones. They've been alluded to. There's no question about that.
Well, I mean, at this point, we all know people, and often lots of people, who were born premature and are alive because of technology.
Well, what's your idea of babies under 25 weeks? How many do you think turn out to be normal?
I have no idea. Please tell us.
Well, I mean, we're talking about imposition of programs or policies and so on. The best information I know of tells you that half of them are unscathed and normal, that another 25% have what was called minor disabilities, and another 25% are the major ones we're talking about. And everything that's been said about having a baby like that is heartrending and true. No question. I wish I could tell which one it is.
Don't we all? What do you think about the case in Texas, Dr. Cronus? Do you think that the right path was followed there, the doctor saying, the hospital saying, we have to go ahead and save this baby, or not?
Well, I really don't know in detail the condition of the baby, but Dr. Allen just told you that if a baby is born vigorous, the scene changes. And I consider that I have no alternative but to support a baby who looks very viable and quite vigorous. Now, you define the vigor in a 23-week-old baby in different terms than you would in a term baby. But nevertheless, it's very difficult to walk away from a baby whose heart rate is 120 and who's trying to breathe and needs some help.
But in this case, before the baby was born, when the parents were told the risks of problems later, they said no, the hospital overruled them. Would you have?
That is a difficult thing. No, I would not agree before birth to do that. And I've been through that. We all have. I've said, yes, if the baby looks really rather hopeless, I can understand. I have no problem with this. If your baby is vigorous, I cannot walk away.
So there are the circumstances where you would overrule parents.
Oh, I've done it, yes. Now, you should understand mm-hmm. that our unit opened in 1968, and I was there. We've cared for 44,000 babies, sick babies, in that period of time. And we have more than our share of sick ones, like so many others do. So it's right or wrong, we've been through the mill several times.
So you feel you're in a position to make pretty good judgments. We've got to take a break. Dr. Sheldon Cronus, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Sure.
Sheldon Cronus is director of the Newborn Center at the Regional Medical Center in Memphis. We're talking about micropreemies and those cases where a decision has to be made whether the life of a very, very young infant will be saved, a premature infant, when there are risks of lifetime complications. What are a parent's rights, a preemie's rights? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the ethical dilemmas that can be raised and have been raised in a Texas courtroom when technology makes it possible to save very prematurely born infants. But the consequences may be great, and if a parent or parents say that they don't want to go ahead with the rescue, should the hospital be able to override? Is it right for a hospital to insist that a micropreemie be saved no matter what the lifetime health consequences? I guess when medicine can play God, are we obligated to go along? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Melissa's on the line. Welcome, Melissa. You're on the air.
First, I have to say that I'm a parent of a very vibrant three-year-old preemie who did tremendously in the neonatal unit.
God bless him and you.
Pardon?
God bless him and you. That's great.
I know. He is a trooper. My question, though, is I'm wondering what the grounds were for the overturning of the lower court's decision, particularly when it seems so clear that the parents had been given the right to choose, mm-hmm. chose, and then the hospital didn't elect
overruled. It's a good question, Melissa. Thanks for raising it. Let's turn to George Annis. Why was this $42 million settlement overturned?
Well, the appeals court decision, which is now being appealed to the Texas Supreme Court, was, to my mind, very bizarre. What the two judges said in the majority was that this case was controlled by the Texas Natural Death Act, which only permits people who are terminally ill to write a living will and thereby grant immunity to their physicians for withdrawing life-supporting treatment. As the dissent said, that law has nothing to do with this case. It's optional, number one. It certainly wasn't designed for fetuses, number two. Its relevance is to grant immunity to physicians. It's not to give you a right to refuse treatment that you didn't already have. So it's just bizarre, and I think that I would hope that will go away in the Texas Supreme Court, and they'll look at the real issue, which is in an emergency or something like an emergency, how do decisions, you know, who gets to make the decision? And if they're time to go to court, do you have to go to court, which is what I hope the Texas Supreme Court will decide. Mm.
Dr. Merrily Allen, is that your reading? And I guess if people see it as an odd decision in the appeals court, or is a decision expected from the Texas Supreme Court that will come down on the side of the parents?
Well, I'm not sure what the Texas Supreme Court will do,
yeah,
but it seems to me that this case is about humanity and medicine and how we make the decisions when enough is enough and who are the most important people to involve in that, which I think is the family.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. That's exactly right.
And in this case, they stood up and they made a decision, and it wasn't allowed to
stand. And
that's
what's so unusual, really. I mean, I think you've heard all night from almost everybody who calls that. Obviously, the natural impulse is to give your child every possible chance. It's only when you're in this situation where the child almost literally seems to have no chance that it, you know, we used to use the term better off dead. I'm not sure that have to be that extreme, but in this case, I think better off not having been treated with extreme measures is true.
Merrily Allen, the Miller family, who now happily, in addition to their child Sydney, have two healthy sons, have said that if they had not had $1 million in health insurance sitting there, they don't believe the hospital would have taken these measures to keep this infant alive. Do you have reason to think that hospitals take money into account when they make a decision like this?
I don't know. I know that it's certainly not anything that I consider when making these decisions with families. And frankly, I agree that hospitals are usually not involved in this. Usually it's between the doctors and the parents and the rest of the staff. So in the sense that we all work for the hospital, they might be involved. But I'm not worried when I'm dealing with these questions with families about who's going to pay for it.
But we know the bean counters are out there, George Annis. The Miller said, if we had been uninsured, we don't think this would have happened.
I think they're probably right. I mean, we know hospitals all over the country are strapped for money, and they not open their doors to the uninsured, I can tell you that.
Stephen is on the line. Welcome, Stephen. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question I'd like to pose to your guests. Given the situation, a woman who's 18 weeks pregnant, she has an amniocentesis. A couple of weeks later, it's discovered that her baby has a genetic anomaly or a chromosomal anomaly. And the decision, obviously, a decision ought to be made there, whether they're going to terminate the pregnancy or continue on with the pregnancy.
Okay.
And a couple makes the decision to terminate the pregnancy. What really is the difference between that type of a decision and the decision that this couple had in Texas had to make?
It's a good question, Stephen. In a way, it's kind of is there an intersection between the ethical conversation around abortion, George Annis, and these cases?
I mean, there is some commonality, but this is not an abortion decision. Abortion is technically a termination of pregnancy before viability.
But they overlap here, don't they?
Well, this was at the edge of viability, and when you get to the edge of viability, I do think things become confused. Once a child is born, however, it's a child. There's no question about that. And I agree with what I took both physicians to say, that you're always better off examining the child after it's born to see what its viability status is than trying to guess before it's born. I think that's correct, that you have to give the child that examination. But, you know, the issue is viability, actually. And here, of course, the parents didn't want an abortion. They were there to have a premature delivery.
They were there for life, but the life that was portrayed or foreseen,
correct.
They wanted to decide against. Mary Lee Allen, if the Texas Supreme Court should decide against the Millers, are we going to see parents frozen out of being able to make decisions about this around the country?
Well, if I worked in Texas, I would worry about that. I'm not sure that decision applies to where I work.
But you know how precedents can ripple across from court to court.
Yes, and that's why I am very concerned in this case, and that's why I was willing to be, in the first place, willing to be a medical expert witness for it, because I do think this is a very important problem that every hospital in the country has to deal with.
We're in a new age. George Annis, final thought. If the Texas Supreme Court should decide against the Millers, how big a deal is this for parents and decision-making in the future?
Well, it depends a lot on what the basis of their decision is. If they have affirm the appeals court, it's no big deal at all, because no
right.
other court in the country would base their law on parents on this Natural Death Act. But I think the real issue is trying to set a standard for decision-making that's more precise in the best interest of the child. And I would think, let me suggest, that reasonable parents concerned with the welfare of their baby should be able to make the decision.
Let's hope so. George Annis, thanks so much for joining us. And Dr. Mary Lee Allen, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
George Annis is chair of the Health Law Department at Boston University School of Public Health, and Dr. Mary Lee Allen is associate director of neonatology at Johns Hopkins Children's Center. You can continue this conversation at our forums. Log on to onpointradio.org. In a moment, the Sheikh of Dubai and the run for the roses. This is On Point. For about 2 minutes tomorrow afternoon, Lexington, Kentucky will become the sports capital of the world. 19 of the world's finest and most expensive thoroughbreds will line up at the post for the 128th running of the Kentucky Derby. Hundreds of millions of dollars are spent on horses each year in a quest to find a winner. No one is spending more in the pursuit of Derby glory than Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum of Dubai. Writer Jason Levine has followed the Sheikh's quest from the deserts of the Middle East to the bluegrass of the Midwest. I spoke with him earlier today and asked him how the royal family of Dubai got into thoroughbred horses.
The thoroughbred breed is actually founded by three stallions from their area of the world, from the Middle East. And they're very well aware of that. And all three brothers were raised around horses. Sheikh Mohammed, who is the driving force of the operation, is a horseman, has been riding since he was 3 years old, and they have a real passion and affinity for the animal and for the breed. So it really, it kind of comes from two directions.
When did the Sheikh and his family burst into the world of the Kentucky Derby?
Well, they burst into thoroughbred horse racing in the late 70s and really big time in about 1980, 81, but they've only really approached and attacked the Derby starting in 1999. And they've run horses every year since, and so far the best they've done is sixth. They are the biggest player in thoroughbred racing in the world by far. As far as money spent, horses owned, races won, they're it. To give you an example, they've spent well over $1 billion in the industry since they started. They own 10,000 acres of prime Kentucky bluegrass. They own 4 or 5 different farms in Kentucky, 8 or 10 farms in Europe, all of which are spectacular. And right now they're spending around $40 to $50 million a year just to try to win the Kentucky Derby.
Now, money alone, we know, doesn't win the Derby. The horse that won
right.
in 2000 cost $4 million. The horse that won in 98, we see, cost $17,000. It's not just the money you plunk down.
No, it's not. And, in fact, the $4 million horse is the only horse to ever win the Derby that cost over $1 million as a yearling. So it really doesn't equate. It's a real crapshoot. It's very difficult to predict. The Sheikh has given himself a major task here and told me it's a much, much harder race to win than he originally thought.
Now, I think the Sheikh recently bought a yearling, Stormcat, for $5.5 million. Is that right?
Yeah, he did. I was there. It was at Keeneland.
This is Keeneland, Kentucky, bluegrass country.
Keeneland, yeah, Lexington, Kentucky, home of the Keeneland yearling sale, which is the classiest yearling sale in the world, has been for about 25 years, and he's been the dominant player. In fact, there were years in the 80s, through the 80s pretty much, where he and his brothers made up between 35 and 45% of the entire sale.
And this is a big money sale. I see that the average price was $400,000 almost, and we've seen horses going for as much as $10 and $13 million.
Yeah, they have bought six of the top 10 yearlings ever. The Irish group called Coolmore has bought the other four. They're really the two top players in the game.
Does the Sheikh keep all of his horses in Kentucky? Does he shuttle them back and forth to Dubai? What's his pattern?
No, he actually shuttles most of them back to Dubai. Since he built the operation up there in the mid-90s, He likes to be around his horses. Like I said, he is a horseman, and he likes to be intimately involved. He's a hands-on owner. Some don't think that's so good, but that's the only way he'll do it, and it is his operation. He runs it his way, and he wants to be there.
How do thoroughbreds like air travel?
They don't, and a lot of people think it's a big negative. The other big negative in his attempt to win the, you know, this America's biggest race is that he refuses to run horses, his horses here in America as three-year-olds. He only runs them in Dubai because he wants to win the race in very unconventional fashion. He wants to break new ground.
So they're not running the sort of warm-up races with the other horses in the crowd.
Exactly. They're running against each other over in Dubai, and a lot of people feel that their horses are not toughened up, they're not sharpened up.
We know that spending money and even years of effort is no guarantee. Others have won the Derby and then spent another 50 years trying to do it again and not succeeded. What's behind Sheikh Mohammed's obsession?
He's won everything else. In Europe, he's won every big race over there. I think that what I found in doing the research for the book and in talking to everybody and talking to him, it's twofold. He really does want to be considered the greatest horseman in the world. And by winning America's greatest race, and some feel the greatest race in the world, and doing it in such unconventional fashion from the desert and flying the horses in, he would be able to lay claim to that title. So that's one big thing. The other big factor, and I think it may even be more important, is he wants to promote Dubai as a business and tourist destination because they're running out of oil, which is what got them, you know, all their wealth or most of it. And they're going to run out in 20 years or so. And he and his brothers are aware of that. They've laid the groundwork. There's a lot of business over there now. They've built these phenomenal hotels right on the Persian Gulf. It's a tiny little country, and the weather's not real good. But they're going all out to make it a spot for people, especially from Europe and the Far East, to vacation because they know that in 20 or 30 years they're going to need another source of income.
Tell us about who the Sheikh has running in the race this year and give us your handicap on it, Jason Levine. What are the Sheikh's chances of taking it?
Well, his horse this year, and it's not a coincidence that it's named this way, is Essence of Dubai. He looks at his two-year-olds. He tries to pick out 8 or 10 that he thinks and his people think will be the best. And put Dubai in the name as another way of promoting the country. So Essence of Dubai is his horse this year. And I think it has the best chance of any of his horses so far. He ran in America last year and ran very well against the best American two-year-olds. He's run twice this year in Dubai, and he won both races. And the last race was a mile and a quarter, which is unconventional because that's the distance of the Derby. And none of the American horses have had the opportunity to run that distance. So he's gone ahead and kind of broken an unwritten rule and given his horse the opportunity to run a mile and a quarter. So he has that advantage coming into the race. I give him a decent chance if he can keep his head about him. He's a very high-strung horse.
What do the bookies have to say? How are the odds running?
He's 15-1 on the morning line. I'm going to guess he's going to go off right around that. He comes from behind, so if he does win, it'll be in thrilling fashion. And ironically, it looks like the Sheikh is not going to attend the races. I think he's a little bit skeptical of dealing with some of the questions that may come at him regarding 9/11. And so despite the obsession and despite all the money he's spending, it doesn't look like he's going to be here.
That's a story. Essence of Dubai. We'll keep our eye on that one at the Kentucky Derby. Jason Levine, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Jason Levine is the author of From the Desert to the Derby. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is WB.